Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast, providing an exclusive look into efforts to conserve the wild things and wild places in Texas.
Hello, I'm Lydia Saldana with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation, and we're here at Bucksnag Hunting Club in Garwood, Texas, with two folks I think you're going to enjoy hearing from, Tyler Sharp and Phil Lamb. And I'll let each one of them tell you a little bit about themselves. Tyler, or no, Phil, you're going like this? Who wants
sure.
to go first?
I'm Phil Lamb. I'm the Director of Development for the Rolling Plains Quail Research Foundation and volunteer for TPWF through their Stewards of the Wild program. I co-chair their Dallas chapter.
And I'm Tyler Sharp. I'm a freelance director, photographer, and writer, and I'm also the editor of Modern Huntsman magazine that is soon to be released.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that.
Absolutely.
But Phil, first tell us, why are we here today? You're here with a group of stewards, so tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we've brought 17 or 18 members of the Dallas chapter of the Stewards of the Wild down here to the Bucksnag Hunting Club. This is our third trip down here for waterfowl hunting. We were out this morning. We shot numerous ducks and had a great hunt. Lots of laughs and smiles and a beautiful sunrise and geese in the distance. And we're going to get out and go do it again in the morning.
Tyler, I hear you don't get out much. So did you enjoy it this morning?
I did, yeah. I mean, most of the time I'm behind the camera. So it's nice that Phil invited me to come down a day early to hang out with the stewards from Texas, or not from Texas, from Dallas, where I live. And actually get to do a little bit of hunting this morning. So that was a nice change of pace. And I'll be shooting more photos tomorrow, but there might be a few in-between moments where I pick the shotgun back up. So
multitasking at its
best,
right?
Yes.
So in the event some of our listeners may not know what Stewards of the Wild is, Phil, fill us in.
Stewards of the Wild is a program that's about 5 years old, started to be an extension of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation for young professionals. And its mission is to really get folks between 20 and 45 years old engaged in conservation issues in Texas and get them outside, knowledgeable about what's going on, and connect with like-minded folks spending time outdoors.
Okay. Now, I know it was two Dallas Stewards members that got the whole thing rolling.
Correct.
Josh McKee and Mac McFarlane, right?
That's right.
They actually called the foundation offices about starting a professionals club, right?
They sure did. They were on a deer hunt in South Texas with some members of the foundation, some commission members, and or actually trustees of the foundation, and decided that there ought to be a way for younger folks, the younger generation, to get involved. So they approached Executive Director Ann Brown and asked if they could start a new program and would she help? This was in 2012, and she was on board immediately, and the Dallas chapter kicked off soon thereafter, and now we are...
We have some dogs that want to join this
we
conversation.
We do, yeah, we have some labs that want to join us, but now we have 7 or 8 chapters across the state. We're nearing 1,000 members, and the program's really taken off.
It's been astonishing, it really has been. Now, I understand that this is not the first time you two have been in the field together, and in fact, there's a connection to Modern Huntsman. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I think that was 2 years ago. I was, Justin Forton, who the chef from Pecan Lodge, is a mutual friend of Phil and I's, and we were trying to do a story for Yeti about kind of like a field-to-table thing. And so Justin invited me to come out on a quail hunt with them, and Phil ended up being there. That was the first time we met, and so we spent a couple days. It was the two of them, and then they both had their sons there. Hunting quail out there, and you know, it was really cool to see them bring their boys and sort of educate. They were 8 at the time?
7.
7, okay. And I actually had my dog, who was a puppy. He was like 8 months old, so it was perfect because it was like the boys and the puppy all got to kind of have this, you know, kind of first time hunting experience. And then, you know, we shot just enough birds to kind of cook a meal for ourselves, and Justin used some of his special secret recipes and cooked this big meal, and it was a great time. And then, you know, through further conversation, we figured out that we had a lot of mutual friends, and Phil and I have just kept in touch over the last couple years, particularly about Modern Huntsman, because it was just sort of in the formation stages there, and I basically said, hey, there's this thing we're doing that I would love to get your opinion on, and or, you know, help spread the word when the time comes. And he was basically like, you just just let me know when you're ready to go, and we'll open the floodgates.
So you knew at the time when you did that hunt that it would end up being a story in this first issue.
I did not know that.
Okay,
yeah, originally the quail hunt was just supposed to be for Yeti, and they ended up not picking the story up because I think that was literally the end of quail season.
It was the last 2 days of the 2016 quail season.
Yeah, so by the time that we got photos to them, they were like, it's not even quail season anymore. So I just had the story for a while. And really didn't kind of wanted to wait to use it for something.
And at the same time, the Modern Huntsman is, I guess you could say, incubating at that time.
Yeah, and just to kind of detail a little bit more about that. Yeah. So essentially, it's a it's many things, but in context of this conversation, it's going to be a biannual publication that's a hunting magazine, but aimed at non-hunters with the purpose of educating folks about how hunting plays a role in conservation. Also presenting a sort of more artistic, softer, I don't know what you want to call it, a little more science-based side of hunting, with the idea being actually trying to improve the perception of hunting in society. And so we have 5 women contributors. My girlfriend's the art director, so she's bringing a very much, you know, sort of a sophisticated feminine perspective to what's otherwise a lot of times a male-dominated editorial world in the hunting magazines. And so... yeah, we did a Kickstarter for 45 days from September to October, raised over $100,000, and are days away from sending it to press. So,
I know when I walked in today, you were poring over your layouts and going through those last minute tweaks.
Final edits. So it's really close. It's been a ton of work, obviously Phil and his son and Justin get to be in this issue. It's a pretty short. I have 3 stories in the issue, but this one's pretty short. But really talking about them educating their boys and the importance of sort of passing this knowledge on for the future of hunting.
Well, I guess I can say that I'm one of the first readers of this publication because you sent me a link for me to review before this conversation.
And yeah.
As I told you, I sent you an email this morning that I had intended just to skim through it and take a look so I wouldn't come into this conversation not knowing what that was about. Mm. And I got so engrossed I pretty much read it cover to cover. It's really a beautiful publication.
Well, thank you.
And the writing is incredible. That first story in the book about the snow geese.
Yeah,
Charles
Post. Yeah, he's my guest editor, and also has become one of my best friends just in how much he's helped me with this. And he's a former. I don't know if he finished his PhD, but he was at Berkeley. So PhD candidate is what they call it. He finished his master's and was on the way for his PhD in ecology, and through his field research, sort of circumnavigated back to, a hunting lifestyle, and the stories about how the overpopulation of snow geese in the Arctic tundra have probably permanently damaged the landscape up there from overgrazing and, destroying the plants that keep the moisture in the soil. So when the sun comes out, it evaporates and turns into salt, and that's totally changed the landscape. And so by managing these populations, they can actually effectively conserve some of these wild areas. And so,
not think about a hunting perspective coming out of Berkeley,
right? And
just saying,
yeah. And it's and he's done. I think that he's done an incredible job of presenting what are otherwise very difficult topics and things that cause a lot of controversy, especially on something like Instagram or Facebook. And he does it in a very know what the right way to say it is, a very delicate and mindful way, but at the same time backed up by really legit research and science that no one else can,
I was
beat him on.
By the combination of science and just beautiful prose.
Yeah. And
and you mentioned to me that his mentor at Berkeley, you kind of described.
Yeah, she was, and I don't know her name, but she's, very, very liberal and was very much an anti-hunter. And he brought the story back to her, and she read it and said, "This is flawless. I mean, I don't necessarily want to go out on a hunt, but I support what you're doing, and I agree with what you're saying, and I think it's wonderful work, so keep it up." So,
and that's kind of the premise of Modern Huntsman.
It is, yeah, and it's been surprising how many, non-hunting vegans even who sent us messages or emails and said, "Hey, I stopped eating meat because of what I felt to be cruel or disrespectful practices, whether that's in commercial, beef industry or this or that, and the way that you're presenting this information has changed my perception of it, and I'm willing to give it a try. And so I don't know if that means down the road maybe we can like pair vegans with hunters and say, hey, you can commission a hunter to go harvest ethical meat from the wild, but certainly a start to
and it's happened. I'm sure it has happened before. So
yeah.
And you know, Tyler, your backstory is a very interesting part of how Modern Huntsman came to be, and I want to get to that in a minute. But Phil, your backstory on how you got into hunting.
Yeah,
tell us about that.
It's not the typical story, I guess. I don't come from a family of hunters or ranchers or landowners or anything like that, but I grew up in a suburb outside Dallas. And when I was 14 years old, got introduced to hunting from my youth minister. And he invited me dove hunting, let me borrow a shotgun, and took me to get my hunting license and taught me to go dove hunting. And we had a fantastic time. From there, learned to waterfowl hunt, and a year or two later got invited on a deer hunt and was eager to go try something bigger than ducks. And next thing I know, I'm chasing antelope and geese, turkeys, anything that we have really in Texas, I'm interested in hunting it.
So starting from when you were a teenager, so when you were at that age, you really didn't understand the role of hunters in conservation.
Oh, no idea. No, I knew it was fun. I knew I enjoyed being outside, but over time, and especially with getting to know the folks at TPWF and volunteering with Stewards of the Wild, started to figure out the role that hunters play in conservation, and that if hunters aren't out there spending their dollars and their time and their resources to conserve the wildlife they care about, really no one else is doing it.
And you get caught up in that, don't you?
Do, very much.
You got really caught up in it, didn't you?
Yeah, I did get caught up in it. Through my volunteer work with TPWF, Ann Brown, the executive director of the foundation, suggested to me that I change careers after being an attorney for 15 or 16 years. Out of the blue, one day she said, "You really like being an attorney?" And she asked me that question. I said, "Well, I seem to enjoy it. It's fine. I went to law school. It's a challenge." And she said, "Well, you really like conservation, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah, I really do. And I've learned a lot." She said, "You could do it full time." So next thing I know, I think within 60 days, I was interviewing with the Rolling Plains Quail Research Foundation for a new position that they had consulted her about, and here I am.
We could do a whole other podcast about the Rolling Plains Quail Research Center. We might, sometime.
Let's talk quail anytime you want.
So that's really awesome. But back to your backstory, mm-hmm. Tyler. Share with the listeners about how you got involved in hunting out of college and kind of that trajectory and how it ended up with a Modern Huntsman.
Sure. I'll try to condense this. But, grew up in Texas, and I did a little bit of hunting here and there, but not ever of my own volition, and it wasn't my friends. It was like my dad went on a corporate bird shooting trip or something, and I got to tag along. And I enjoyed it, but didn't really know enough about it to really be able to defend myself. So I went to school in Los Angeles, and a lot of things came under fire being in a different environment, different from where I grew up. So I kind of had to decide what I stood for and what I didn't stand for based on what I was taught and all that kind of stuff. Graduated from college, and my first job was in Tanzania, Africa, where I was going to be filming and photographing hunting safaris. And when I told a lot of my friends out there in California, a lot of them turned on me and had really, I don't know if dramatic is the right word, but heated reactions to that. And, some of them stopped being my friend, which was really surprising. And I didn't, at the time, didn't really know how to react to that or how to even defend it, because I'd never been and I didn't know how it worked. So when I went over there, life-changing experience, I spent 6 months in the bush tried to learn since then as much as I could about how it actually works, because people do develop these seemingly very strong emotional attachments to animals they've never seen, and then they sort of have these violent emotional reactions when they hear about people hunting
and individual
them.
Animals.
Yes, and
names, right?
Yeah, and so I've just tried to make it a point to be as educated as I could in those areas, and I just feel like with anything in life, that if you're going to speak out about something or challenge someone, that you should know what you're talking about, and most people don't, which is unfortunate. And whether that's talking about conservation or whether it's talking about who won the national championship 7 years ago.
That's one of the articles that you wrote in this initial issue, was about that whole African hunting, what that means for conservation in Africa, which it was eye-opening. I didn't know a lot of this stuff. And I think, and I'm in conservation, and I would bet a lot of people don't know, you know, anything about it.
Well, worse than people not necessarily knowing the facts are the reality that a lot of news outlets and mass media or mainstream media actually spreads misinformation, where they actually present things as fact that are in fact not facts. I mean, I just said fact three times in the same sentence, but the deliberate misdirection and misappropriation, and you know, just trying to smear the name of it, and
or sometimes ignorant. It's not necessarily deliberate all the time. But
yeah,
there is
that's
some
true.
Ignorance there too.
Yeah, but there's certainly you know, a lot of anti-hunting campaigns that say things like murder, which the term murder means human to human. So the very basis of that isn't a fact, you know. And so, but, you know, during that time between 2007 and 2011, I think I went to almost 30 countries filming hunts all over the world and kind of saw the common thread of, you know, not just conservation, but, you know, sort of cultural relevance and fellowship. And, you know, you could go to any country in the world and you find a hunter. And even if you don't speak their language, tracking an animal more or less is something that you understand how to do, you know, on the same level. And so all of that experience kind of leading to this magazine, kind of born out of frustration with having to have these conversations over and over again, and how not only ignorant some people are, but adamantly opposed based on things they read that were not true. And so it's a little bit of undoing some of that, but it's also showing a different side of it. So it's not just the anti-hunting. It's actually, there's a lot of hunters who do a disservice to the tradition by showing a lack of respect, or, you know, just being really aggressive in online forums and, you know, kind of brazen about it. And those sort of conflicts, in my opinion, do more damage than they do good. So we're not trying to necessarily call anybody out, but we're trying to show a different side of it that hopefully people can start to make those distinctions for themselves. And they say, okay, well, those people call themselves hunters and conservationists, but they're not. They're, you know, whatever we want to call it.
Yeah.
And then this is a little bit different. So we're helping that sort of leading by example and showing that there's people who do have a lot of respect and do, you know, care even from an ecology standpoint and are trying to preserve wild spaces and species, but based on the principles of hunting. So.
It seems like we're at a moment in time where there seems to be a renewed interest in hunting, a renewed interest in what it means, whether it's the fact that you started a crowdfunding thing and you went over your goal, a lot of interest in this, Stewart's taking off like it has. What do y'all think about that? What's your perception of that?
People seem to want to know more than ever where their food's coming from, and hunting is a way to guarantee that. I think that's one of the motivations. People are having a greater appreciation for getting outside now more than ever. So I think you're seeing a renewed interest in getting outdoors, whether that's kayaking or hiking or going out and trying to learn a new skill. And you see a variety of ways to do it. Some people are rifle hunting and some people are using shotguns for upland bird hunting, and some folks are going straight towards archery, which is technically hard and very sporting and very difficult. And a lot of people are attracted to that fact.
Yeah, and I would say in the same vein, you know, there's in cities where you might traditionally consider that to be a very liberal environment that would be against hunting, you know, you've seen these sort of farm-to-table, field-to-table restaurants, or, you know, in Portland you can go to the butcher where maybe they can tell you the cow's name that it came from, and people are into that. And so by sort of operating in that same vein with the same sense of respect, and sort of showing people that it's not that different from going out and harvesting your own elk, you know, and the amount of work that goes into doing something like that versus what they would see, you know, splashed across a controversial news headline or something like that. But then I also think that with situations like, you know, this whole Bears Ears National Monument thing, that people are starting to realize that even if they haven't been in these places, that the public places and the public lands, whether you're a hunter or not, are shared space amongst recreational, you know, outdoors people. And that if they can't figure out how to work together to protect what's there, I think that, you know, they've realized that. And so I feel like you've started to see more cooperation across the board between, you know, what would traditionally be just hikers who were against hunting, but now you're kind of seeing that come together.
Common ground.
Ground, because there's only so much of it, and I think, you know, we're the only nation in the world that has this amount of public access land, and I think people are starting to see the value of it, and we're trying to also, without being really in your face about it, say, hey, look, you realize that a lot of this has to do with all these dollars generated from, you know, from hunting, and more in a, in an educational sort of intellectual tone than a sort of shake your finger talking down to. So,
what do you hope to accomplish with Modern Huntsman?
A lot of stuff. I mean, you know, the mission sort of that we've written is we're trying to improve the perception of hunting. And we're not trying to battle and fight and change the minds of people who would are vehemently against hunting, because I feel like those are lost causes. But, you know, the 70 to 80% of the population that's in the middle that maybe had a grandpa that hunted, and, you know, maybe they're not going to go on a hunt themselves, but we're trying to at least reason with people and sort of explain the landscape of the situation, so that in hopes that when the situation arose, that they wouldn't speak out against it, that they would at least be informed. And when they saw some sensationalized, you know, misinformation, they would be like, oh, that's actually not the case, or that's not the deal. And beyond that, you know, we're wanting the website to be a resource for people to educate themselves. So, you know, a lot of brands like Yeti and Sitka and are producing these beautiful conservation films, but they're scattered across different YouTube channels, or if you're not following them on Facebook, you may not have seen it come out. So we're trying to sort of condense all of that into one place, but then also lean on guys like Simon Roosevelt, who's one of our columnists and our advisor. And I talked to Phil about this too, you know, specific to Texas, you know, the Stewards of the Wild and TPWF could provide a lot of information specific to the state of Texas. But then guys like Simon, who are involved in, you know, Boone and Crockett and Shikar, and, you know, he's on the President's Council of Environmental, I don't even know. His bio is so long that we had to cut it down because he's just involved in everything in terms of actual conservation. And so,
and of course, the name.
Right,
he's
right.
He's directly related.
Yeah, he's the great-great-grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, and is sort of the first one in his family to take the mantle back up. And, you know, but he's also made a point that he doesn't want to be directly associated with TR's views. And while, yes, TR did some great work, you know, he's trying to bring a perspective that's more relevant to today's world versus the world of, you know, 1904, that whenever that was that it was decreed. And so, you know, we want to make sure that the information we're presenting is accurate, that it's relevant and it's current, and that, you know, if somebody really wanted to get involved with something, that this could be a place where they could go and find out how to do that.
And Phil, where are you hoping Stewards goes in the future? What do you think about the goals and direction for the Stewards of the Wild?
I really hope it continues to grow. One of the most encouraging things we've seen with Stewards in the last year is the growth that we've seen in some of the smaller markets. After already having chapters in Austin and San Antonio, Houston, Dallas, and Fort Worth, now we're expanding into Midland and Bryan College Station and Tyler. And not really knowing what we would see in Midland, 300 people showed up for our first event.
That was amazing.
Yeah, and there was clearly a unsatisfied need for something like that out there. Connect outdoors interested folks into one place and to have common ground together and learn, and it's a very active chapter already. They're going out and working in state parks, and they're working with ranchers to adjust barbed wire fences so pronghorn can get through, and things that are really truly making a difference. So I hope with the Stewards program that it continues to grow and we expand into even more markets, and we do so in a genuine way that makes a difference, as opposed to signing up for a group and just going to a happy hour and getting your drink ticket. We really try to have an educational component to everything that we do, and more importantly, a hands-on component where you get to go out and make a difference, either teaching someone or taking a child fishing or improving a state park or some habitat work.
You know, it's always good to end these things on a good story. And certainly in the first issue of Modern Huntsman, there are some great stories in there. And I could talk about each one of those, but don't want to be a spoiler here. But I think I do want to be a spoiler on one, which is your adventure story about your encounter with the lion.
Sure. Yeah, this is over the years become known as the lion story. But yeah, I was in, there's a floodplain in central Tanzania called the Kilimanjaro Valley, and the grass is about 12 feet tall, and there's no trees. And they call it elephant grass because it covers the backs of elephants. And you hunt by a triple-decker boat. You kind of go down the river, and a Maasai sits on top and just looks for the oxpecker birds on the back of buffalo. And so we would kind of just traverse the rivers day after day, and we would see the oxpeckers on the back, and the driver would sort of run the boat into the bank, and we'd get out and hike in there, not knowing if it's even a buffalo or if it's a male or a female. And, you know, it has to be past a certain age, and horns have to be a certain size of a male to ensure, you know, maturity and all that. So anyways, we were there for a couple months, and it was so hot, even at night, that you had to sleep with the tent doors open. And the zipper on the mesh door was broken. And I told my friend, the professional hunter, Georgie, that we should get it fixed. And he's like, don't be a wuss or whatever. And I was like, all right. And woke up, you know, the next night at about 3 a.m., hearing the which is a male lion right behind the tent. And, you know, I kind of sat there for a second and thought, all right, do I have time to get out? And, you know, I have to run outside and untie both flaps and, like, roll the canvas down and then jump back in and zip it down. And by the time I even, like, flinched to think about going, he called right next to my head, about 6 inches away, outside the window of the tent. And these are, you know, these are 8-foot canvas tents, and there's bed frames. So it's a nice tent. It's not like a little, you know, camping tent. But it's still it's probably a 600-pound lion. And so at that point, I just kind of braced myself. And he stepped out into – it was a full moon. So he stepped out about 6 or 7 yards away, and it's the biggest lion I've ever seen. It was massive. And he kind of stopped, and I reached down. If he came, I was going to grab the bed frame and, like, flip it on top of myself. And as I reached down, the bed creaked, and he just goes, whoo, and just turns around and just stares me right in the eyes about 5 yards away. And so I'm crouched down holding this bed frame, and he, like, starts to kind of crouch and, like, dig his paws into the sand like he was going to pounce. And I was just thought, all right, you know, here it goes. Here's where I get eaten by a lion.
This is it.
And then he, you know, his tail was kind of flicking like a house cat. And then he just turned around and walked over to the edge of the forest and, like, rubbed his face on the fence and jumped in the river and swam off. And, of course, I woke Georgie up, the PA. I'm like, Georgie, that lion was here. And he gets up and, you know, starts acting all tough, you know, with his double rifle. And the tracks were massive. The funny part of the story is that it was so hot there that I decided to shave my head. But Georgie was like, let's do a mohawk first. And I was like, all right, you know, like, you know, I'm going to be in the bush for another 3 months. So we had shaved this mohawk into my head. That lion had a mohawk mane. Like, it was missing all the hair around its neck. And so it just had this sort of mohawk mane.
Your spirit animal.
Well, so the next full moon, exactly 1 month later, the same lion comes back to the same tent. But this time, the canvas door was closed. And he laid on the front porch and, like, sagged the tent wall in and was just sprawled out on the porch of this tent, just going, like, just breathing, and it was moving the tent wall, you know? And I like, touched the wall, you know, and could, like, feel him, and he just... At that point, yes, I decided that it was my spirit animal. So, but yeah, but then he left, and we never saw him again. But I like to think I gained some lion spirit from that. So
that's quite a story. Phil, I hate to ask you for a story out in the field, because I don't think you can top that, but
no,
I know every
not.
Time you go out in the field, it's a different experience, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. That's the amazing thing, is you can gather hunters, and Modern Huntsman is doing this on its website and through its magazines. You can gather hunters around a table, and you can share stories. That's the beautiful thing about this. And things like this stewards event, when we all go out with our different guides in the morning, and then we gather back here at the Buck Snag, and we hear the stories. We hear about the missed shots or the close calls or the whooping crane off of the distance. That's the real treat. And so to gather in one place and to have fellowship outdoors, that's what we're all doing here together. And it's great to have those times.
So if folks want to find out about becoming part of the Stewards Program, where do they go? What do they do?
You can go to stewardsthewild.org. That's probably the easiest place to go, and you can check out all of our chapter lists and sign up easily right there. We're also very active on Facebook and Instagram. Each chapter has their own account, and each chapter really has its own personality too. So if you're by one of the major or nearby one of the major cities in Texas, you know, I encourage you to check out that particular city's Facebook page or Instagram account. But even if you're not, you'll see what we're up to and get a real sense of what the group's about.
And Tyler, if people want to get involved with Modern Huntsman.
Sure. Yeah, so we're still accepting pre-orders for the magazine. It's modernhuntsman.co. And the issue should ship out in the next couple of weeks. But yeah, we post pretty consistently on Instagram. It's just at Modern Huntsman. And then after the issue releases, you know, we'll be releasing a lot of the content we shot during the Kickstarter campaign, the interviews with the contributors, and little behind-the-scenes stories of, you know, some of these essays we put together. But then also, you know, just sort of the personal philosophies of a lot of the people involved. And it was so hard to narrow down to 14 people because there's just so many talented photographers and writers out there who care about this sort of thing. And so, you know, it's been amazing the sort of support we've received and people that have sort of come out of the woodwork to show support and really beyond anything I expected. So,
well, I'm already looking forward to the next issue.
So yeah. I'm not quite there yet.
Even if somebody picks up this podcast a few weeks or a month from now, they can go to that website and order the issue if there's copies left.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we're going to print about 4,000 of them. We sold, I think, 2,200 through the Kickstarter. We're printing 4,000 with the first run, and then we're hoping to start getting into some distribution with stores and coffee shops and Amazon and things like that. So,
and there's only going to be two issues a year.
Yeah, biannual.
Right?
Yeah, two a year.
So every issue is a big deal, and you should track it down.
Definitely, it's 204 pages. I didn't mention that.
Yeah,
so with the first issue has zero ads. So
it's
that was
beautiful.
A major part of
it. Really
so.
Beautiful. Well, thank you both for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah,
happy hunting tomorrow.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast is brought to you by Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation, supporting high-impact conservation projects across the state. Find out how you can help at tpwf.org.